The longest-serving current member in the House of Representatives, John Conyers of Michigan, is under investigation by the House Ethics Committee. The committee opened an investigation Tuesday into sexual harassment complaints against Representative Conyers. He acknowledged this week that he had settled sexual harassment complaints with a former staffer, but denied the allegations of sexual harassment after reports Monday on the 2015 settlement and allegations of sexual misconduct from several female staff members. Sexual harassment scandals on Capitol Hill. That's where we begin our week in review with Kevin Benversi. He is the research director with Media Trackers, a conservative media group. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Morning. Thanks for having me on.
And Matt Rothschild is here. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, which tracks campaign finance. Matt, welcome to the show.
Hey, Kate. Thanks for having me on this day after Thanksgiving.
Well, we're going to spend the first chunk of this hour on the latest sexual harassment revelations facing prominent people. Veteran journalist Charlie Rose has been fired by CBS and PBS over eight women saying he made unwanted sexual advances toward them. Rose has apologized for what he called inappropriate behavior, though he said not all of the allegations are accurate. What do you make of this, Kevin, of these allegations that continue to be coming out, regardless of the profession, of the industry?
What's most amazing to me is just the rate that these are coming out. I don't think it's that surprising that you're hearing these come out. I mean, you have this Me Too movement. There is a question. I mean, and I think it's a legitimate theory that I've heard some that have said, you know, is this kind of, you know, societal cultural backlash from those who are upset that Donald Trump is president. So they're basically saying, well, wait a minute, if all these accusations against him during the Access Hollywood video didn't come out, you know, what about the guys who are pushing it now? Which, of course, you know, there's other things we could debate about. You know, would if Hillary Clinton was president, would Harvey Weinstein still be running his company, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, with all his political connections? But that being said, I mean, it's amazing to see happen. I mean, you had this log roll or ball rolling, you know, like even years before with Bill Cosby, Roger Ailes, Bill O'Reilly, others. But I mean, just see the momentum go on. It's amazing. But I mean, the only concern I have, I mean, with a lot of these allegations is, will the due process take place? Because, you know, say what you want with the political ramifications that, you know, it's serious and whatnot, but there are legal ramifications, and, you know, you are allowed to be found innocent until proven guilty.
And Matt, media not immune from this problem.
No, this is kind of a pivotal cultural moment for us, I think. It's a time of reckoning. I mean, it's disgusting. It's disgusting how much sexual abuse is out there by people in positions of power. That's been the shocking thing to me, and I suppose I've been naive here in my little cubby holes in Madison, Wisconsin. But, you know, Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas, that thing broke 26 years ago. And I would have thought, you know, people's behavior would have been corrected and that employers would have been worried about liability. Of course, the U.S. Supreme Court has loosened up some of that liability. But to have this disgraceful, obscene, grotesque behavior going on at such a rampant rate in every industry, and, you know, it's an accountability time. I mean, people need to take accountability for their actions, fall on their swords, get out of the way, you know, fumigate the atmosphere, and let's get on to a better American society where women aren't prey.
Well, a second woman has accused Democratic Senator Al Franken of Minnesota of touching her inappropriately in 2010 when Franken was, in fact, a member of the Senate. According to a Politico poll, 50% of those surveyed say he should resign. 22% say he should not. Two-thirds say the Senate Ethics Committee should investigate this matter. Kevin, what would you say?
Well, actually, let me correct you on something. It's now up to four women with Senator Franken.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That,
yeah.
That happened over Thanksgiving, so it's now up to four women.
Okay.
What worries me with the Franken situation is that he was essentially given an out with the Senate Ethics Committee. The Senate Ethics Committee is a black hole where no one ever gets punished, no one ever gets held accountable, and essentially he's hoping that he can run the clock out and that this will all disappear and whatever. And since no doubt it's going to get brought up, I don't want Al Franken in the Senate. I don't want Roy Moore in the Senate. I think both men are despicable human beings who should never be given the title of U.S. Senator. And what's amazing to watch, and I'm sure Matt has seen this on his side too, is the tribalism that's come, the rally around the flag. And we could go all this, you know, going all the way back to Bill Clinton, where Democrats did not have the moral conviction or the will of character to urge him to resign. Suddenly you're seeing it now, 25 years later, in a whole bunch of op-eds by guys like Matt Iglesias and, excuse me, others who were high schoolers, but, you know, now at the time and now are in their 30s and going, well, maybe we were wrong at the time, you know, or we were just so, you know, angry at the right. Well, the question is, if when you're having this going on, is you need to have moral clarity, you need to have the moral conviction to say, if this guy's a scuzzbag, we should not be associated with him. And, I mean, it's weird in the sense that, you know, I may be the only one of our two guests who can actually say, I did not vote for Bill Clinton, I did not vote for Donald Trump.
Actually, I didn't either. I didn't never voted for Bill Clinton.
You did not vote for Bill Clinton. I'm sorry, man. I did not realize that.
That's all right.
The reality of it is that both sides, because it's their guy, are doing all they can to defend them, which is ingratiating and gross. And frankly, it needs to stop. We need to say, as a culture, as a society, some behavior is completely unacceptable.
Well, it calls to mind, Kevin, it calls to mind this quote I saw from the legal representation of Representative Conyers saying, and I'm paraphrasing, that if all of the allegations out there came out, we'd have a lot of unemployed men. And it struck me, Matt, because what's happening here? I mean, what would Franken do in this situation? He issued an apology. Should he step down?
Yeah, it's time to clean house. I think Al Franken should step down. He put out a statement, I think, yesterday or the day before saying, I crossed the line. You know, he's grabbing women's backsides in pictures. And of course, there's the Leanna Tweeden thing that started the whole thing. I think he should resign. I think John Conyers should resign. I think people in across industries should resign who've been doing this and getting away with this. And we need to move on. But we need to move on after those who have done despicable things take themselves out of power.
And Kevin, there was this issue, perhaps, we don't know quite the ramifications here, but that Conyers used taxpayer money to settle a sexual harassment accusation. The paper said that the deal looks an awful lot like hush money. Conyers has denied any wrongdoing.
This feels literally like the Bill O'Reilly stuff, but with taxpayer dollars. That's how I kind of view it, in the sense where you were literally having the employers of these guys issue settlements. And if you know anything about how Congress operates and the way it deals with sexual harassment things, I mean, and so on and so forth, it's so Byzantine, it's so unprotective of the accuser. And, you know, the fact that, you know, and it's Conyers, who's 88, he's been there forever. If Democrats take the House, he's the head of the Judiciary Committee. So imagine that wonderful little sideshow then. So, I mean, it's amazing to see happen that, you know, I mean, where is Mark Pocan? Where is Gwen Moore to say anything about this? No one's put a microphone in their face. They're off hiding wherever. I mean, but if it happens, I mean, and part of me, what irritates me is the media double standard. If it's a Republican, every Republican gets a microphone on their face. If it's a Democrat, suddenly all these guys are allowed to go into hiding, or they're allowed to issue a single statement after hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of media requests, and that's the only thing that's allowed to come out.
Well, if you want to talk about double standards, though, let's look at the President of the United States. I mean, the President of the United States made fun of Al Franken, calling him Frankenstein, for the sexual allegations against Franken, when Trump himself has 13 women or more who have accused him of all sorts of illegal acts of sexual abuse and sexual assault. And then look at Trump on Roy Moore. Roy Moore, who's a pedophile. Roy Moore, who's kicked out of a mall and has the police in his town watch him at high school football games because he's trying to get at the cheerleaders. And what did Donald Trump say this week? We don't need a liberal in there, a Democrat.
And we're going to get to Roy Moore's situation in just a moment. We are in Week in Review. Kevin Benversi is the research director with Media Trackers, a conservative media group. Matt Rothschild is here as well. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, which tracks campaign finance. You can join in this conversation, 800-642-1234. Should Representative John Conyers resign from Congress? What about Al Franken? How do you feel about President Trump sticking up for Roy Moore? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll be back in just a moment. House Speaker Paul Ryan said in a statement this week, quote, "People who work in the House deserve and are entitled to a workplace without harassment or discrimination." Ryan said he asked last month for a review of all policies and procedures related to workplace harassment and discrimination. We're discussing harassment complaints on this portion of Week in Review with Matt Rothschild, the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and Kevin Benversi, the research director with Media Trackers. Your thoughts on the week's news? How do you feel about President Trump sticking up for Republican Senate candidate Roy Moore this week? Here in Wisconsin, how do you feel about Turning Point USA being recognized as a student group on the UW-Stevens Point campus? 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. President Trump left for his Florida estate Tuesday to celebrate Thanksgiving, but not before talking to reporters about Alabama's Senate race. The president told voters not to back the liberal Doug Jones against Republican Roy Moore, who's facing several sexual misconduct allegations from when he was in his 30s. And here's a snippet from what he said.
Mr. President, is an accused child molester better than a Democrat? Is an accused
child molester better than a Democrat? Well, he denies it. I mean, if you look at what is really going on and you look at all the things that have happened over the last 48 hours, he totally denies it. He says it didn't happen. And, you know, you have to listen to him also.
Kevin, what about this response from the president on Roy Moore?
I think it was not just unwarranted. I think it was despicable. I think paraphrase my former mentor and former employer, Charlie Sykes, this puts a scarlet P on every Republican for pedophile. With what the president has just done, because he's essentially defended a guy who, you know, is under numerous allegations that date back decades with some despicable things. I don't, you know, care, you know, if, you know, he has been married 30-some years and has run for statewide office countless times. This feels, and I've been reading the stories, that this is still the long tentacle of Steve Bannon wrapped around Donald Trump, that you have Bannon, who is doing all he can to keep Roy Moore afloat, calling the president saying, you know, sir, this is just like Access Hollywood. You know, if you survive that, he can survive this, and all this other stuff going, you know, that's great and all, but you have to draw a line in the sand. And to see Trump essentially give Moore a pass, you know, and stick with his, I don't know if he stuck with his post primary endorsement or not, but to say that, well, it's better than a Democrat is like, okay, yeah. I mean, this feels, like I said, this all goes back to the tribalism that's now really inherent in our politics, where, you know, and I made the joke after it first came out. I think I said something on Twitter. I said, for those freaking out that, you know, people are still backing Roy Moore, keep in mind that Democrats in Missouri voted for a dead man over John Ashcroft in 2000.
Matt, Alabama's governor said she'll vote for Roy Moore.
Yeah, it's a total disgrace. It's a huge blot on the White House. It's a huge blot on the Republican Party. And this guy is accused of just some of the most disgusting things. And one anecdote that sticks in my mind, he was allegedly assaulting a 16-year-old, and he said, I'm the district attorney. This is when he was DA. and you're a child, who's going to believe you? This is about total abuse of power, and it's about sexual assault with a minor, and appears to be getting away with it in the White House.
Let's go to Thomas in Milwaukee. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Hi. I'm just wondering about, you know, you guys have yet to talk about at what point we're meant to suspend the presumption of innocence that everybody's entitled to, whether you're an average citizen or a politician. I mean, I think it is relatively rare, but we've had some fairly high profile cases in recent memory of false accusations, the UVA rape thing and the Duke lacrosse thing. And I know, you know, these guys are politicians and it's not a trial, but really it's kind of a fundamental bedrock liberal principle that no matter who you are, these things are allegations until they're proven. And if you say it's not a court of law, it's the court of public opinion, well, that's fine. Well, then shouldn't we be able to, in the court of public opinion, raise questions about some of these allegations and get to the bottom of them? Also, I'm wondering, you know, we seem to be lumping all of this together. You have Al Franken, who, you know, had a picture out there of kind of some lewd conduct and then some other allegations. But that's different than the stuff that Roy Moore is accused of, which would be criminal, and it's really vile. So I'd caution our guests to kind of lump all of these together. It all depends on the facts and circumstances. And I think we're getting to a point here where we're confusing a lot of things, and it's becoming kind of a witch hunt mentality. And
Thomas, thanks so much for calling in with those observations. Kevin, go ahead first to respond.
Well, the caller brought up something I said initially, which is there is this fear that there is no due process in this, and that you are dealing with essentially public relations fights versus legal fights. And that's always the touchy part, which is, you know, you're allowed in a court of law to prove your innocence. You're not really allowed in the court of public opinion to prove your innocence. Basically, it becomes who believes whom, and that's always the tricky part. I mean, he's very, you know, correctly brings up things such as the Duke lacrosse case and the UVA rape case, which, you know, this essentially kind of destroyed Rolling Stone magazine. But how those guys were railroaded, and that you had people who were trying to get convictions, you know, were their lives were destroyed. So I mean, it is a concern, and I think the problem you're dealing with, you're walking a fine line between what is acceptable public behavior versus what is acceptable legal behavior. And in the cases of Moore and Franken, I mean, it's weird in the sense how you have actual physical evidence against Franken. You don't have anything other than rumor, accusation, and a yearbook. I think it's a yearbook photo with Moore, but there's no actual like physical evidence. So it's weird in this whole kind of which could you prove in a court of law. So, I mean, I'm probably rambling, and I apologize.
Well, yeah, and let's get Matt on here to respond. Matt, go ahead.
Well, we're not in a court of law, and there's a mountain of women who've come out against Roy Moore. There are police officers who've come out against Roy Moore saying that they were supposed to, you know, patrol the high school football game or patrol the mall and keep them away from the young girls. And also there are people who've done this who've admitted to doing inappropriate things. Charlie Rose admitted to doing inappropriate things. Al Franken said he crossed a line. And I do think that false allegations are very, very rare. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage for women to come forward with these accusations when it's embarrassing, troubling, nightmarish, might have an adverse effect on their careers. I tend to believe the women who are coming out here, and I just think we need to have this conversation and have people take responsibility for their actions and stop apologizing or extenuating for the guys who've done some disgusting things.
We're going to move on now to some other topics. Tax overhaul: after Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson made news for saying he could not support the Senate tax plan in its current form because it's too hard on pass-through businesses, he said last weekend that he's optimistic about the situation.
The president called me, Speaker Ryan called me. I got a call from Mnuchin, Cohn. I met with both of those individuals, with their staff, on the drive down here. I had a good talk with the Senate Finance and Majority Leader's staff. We're defining the problem. We're getting the information we need so we can actually fix this problem. So, no, I'm pretty encouraged with the reaction.
Johnson said the proposal treats large corporations more favorably than small businesses, which he said are the foundation, the bedrock of local communities. Matt, what do you make of where Ron Johnson is coming in at pass-through businesses, wanting to make them on equal ground to what corporations pay?
Well, I'm not an expert on pass-through businesses, but I see Ron Johnson's behavior as just kind of another grandstanding act like he did with the Obamacare repeal, where he comes out and seems to be bravely breaking from his party, and then with a small concession here or there, he steps back into line. So he gets the limelight for a week or two, and then, you know, he's just a good soldier. So I never put much stock in his criticism of this tax bill anyway, because I thought he was going to fall back into line, and lo and behold, he has.
Well, Kevin, you know, Ron Johnson, his family has a pass-through business.
Can I just say stop the press? As Matt from Matt Rothschild just agreed with Jim Sensenbrenner on something. I actually understand where. So I worked on Ron Johnson's campaign in 2010 as research director. So I've known Ron for a number of years, and I know where he comes from. This is about type S corporations, and this is actually where a lot of your smaller manufacturers and smaller businesses qualify under the tax code. This is a legitimate concern that Ron has when it comes to business development in this state, in this country. And what happens is you have these companies qualify or file as type S corporations, which then basically says all the money that the company makes is technically declared as money for the employer. So then they're paying a higher tax rate while you have some corporation, which, as you see through the tax bill, wants to get to 20%. Is then paying you lower tax. So then that pass-through income is then taxed at a higher rate to the owner. So my understanding between the two bills, and that's why I said he talked with Speaker Ryan, he talked with others, is that pass-through part is in the House bill. It's not in the Senate bill. So my hope is that Speaker Ryan is telling Senator Johnson, Ron, don't worry, we'll get it in conference. And that's maybe what's happening. I don't know. That's just speculation on my part. That's complete conjecture. But that's my feeling. And, you know, to say, well, Ron Johnson's grandstanding. No, Ron Johnson's having a legitimate concern.
Well, let's
Ron
bring in.
Not grandstanding.
Let's bring in Ned now to the conversation on this. Hi, Ned. Go ahead.
Yes. Well, if Senator Johnson would follow through with his original statement and vote against the tax reform bill based on too much of the benefit being to large corporations and not small businesses, I would support him on that and thank him for that. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like he's very dependable on his original idea, and he may be caving as people tend to come towards him with lobbying. Unfortunately, all five Republican Wisconsin Congress members in the House voted for this terrible bill, which gives two-thirds of all the tax cuts to large corporations, $1 trillion out of the $1.5 trillion, and makes them permanent, whereas the tax cuts for individuals actually are much smaller, and they are phased out. In the first few years, there's greater benefit on tax cuts for individuals, but they are phased out over a few years, and then when we get in a few years from now, it will be much worse for most people's individual tax returns. And finally, the money's going to have to come from somewhere. In the place where the greatest benefits are Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. And so those have got to be on the chopping block to pay for these large tax cuts, of which two-thirds of the benefit goes for large corporations.
Matt, would you like to respond here first to Ned's comments?
Well, I share Ned's general criticism of the tax bill. This is a huge early Christmas present for large corporations and the super wealthy, getting rid of the estate tax that only helps a couple thousand people in the country who have estates greater than $5.5 million right now, getting rid of the alternative minimum tax that only helps people above a certain amount. And the reason they're doing it is because their donors want them to do it. I mean, there's been amazing concessions by some Republican elected officials. Senator Cory Gardner, for instance, of Colorado says, donors are furious. We haven't kept our promise. We need to keep our promise. Or Representative Chris Collins, my donors are basically saying, get it done or don't ever call me again. Mm-hmm. And those donors are rich donors. And so that's who's driving the bus here.
Well, the Senate tax plan includes a provision to repeal the Affordable Care Act's individual mandate, which imposes a fine on people who don't buy health insurance. But White House Budget Director Mick Mulvaney said on CNN last weekend that it's not a must-have for the final legislation.
If we can repeal part of Obamacare as part of a tax bill and have a tax bill that is still a good tax bill that can pass, that's great. If it becomes an impediment to getting the best tax bill we can, then we're okay with taking it out. So I think it's up to the Senate and the House to sort of hammer out those details.
Well, Kevin, it looks like there's some squishiness on this, that there could be, the concessions here.
Well, I think probably the end bill to make sure it passes, it probably won't be in there. But to quote Senator Cornyn of Texas, Supreme Court ruled it a tax, so it's on the table. So that's my take on the individual mandate. I thought it was a abysmal piece of policy, and it's still an abysmal piece of policy. You shouldn't have the threat of government forcing you to buy anything, but clearly we now do. So, but as for the other comments for the caller, I have issues with the tax bill, but most of those are because you feel that this is being written to ensure it passes through reconciliation, not to ensure that it's smart policy. And that's leading to some really strange things being added or being taken out of the bill. I think at the end of the day, I think something will pass the Senate, either with a 51 or 50 vote squeaker majority with Mike Pence casting the tie vote. But, the real battle is going to be in conference and what comes out in conference. And that's always a toss-up. So whatever the legislation.
Let's bring in Karen in Rice Lake with a comment. Hi, Karen.
Hi there. I wanted to talk about the tax code and its relationship to women. You know, we've been talking this morning on the show about the assaultive behavior of men towards women. And frankly, this tax code, which will target Medicaid, Medicare, people who don't have as much money, is going to adversely impact women. And because we are often the ones who are on Medicaid, we are often the ones that survive into elder years on Medicare, and we are often the ones who are making less money. So I think that overall, as a body, people have to look at the impact and how it impacts women's lives much differently when these kinds of foolish and draconian tax codes are put into play. So when we're talking about assaultive behavior, let's talk about the way that the entire body is assaultive towards women in their lives.
And Matt, go ahead.
Well, I think Karen makes a good point about the cuts to Medicaid and Medicare that are coming and how they would disproportionately affect women. And I would encourage listeners to Google a YouTube video of Senator Claire McCaskill talking with Orrin Hatch and saying, you say you're helping middle-income people, but you're really hurting them. It's just a little five-minute video that is tremendously kind of illustrative, partially of the point that Karen's making.
And Kevin, what do you feel about the approach in this tax code overhaul? We've been hearing that the cuts will be there, that the exemptions, the personal exemptions, there's a debate over that. But how does this really impact middle-class Americans?
That, again, goes to, a lot of the issues with the bill is, you're in order to get what you want, which... I mean, I'm for the corporate tax cut because it'll make the country much more competitive internationally. That's why we're seeing money like, companies, suddenly set up their headquarters overseas because the tax rate's cheaper over there than it is in America, even though like 80 to 90% of their business is done in the United States. That's the whole reason but we're doing this to make the tax code more competitive internationally, there's going to be, you know, and this is also the problem with having a tax code that has been socially engineered for the last 30, 50, how many years to pick out society's winners and losers, that if you're tinkering and you're getting into that engine, parts are going to be removed, and that's going to hurt this person, or parts are going to be added. It's going to help this person.
Or as Karen says, you know, the trade-offs will be the welfare of women in America.
Potentially, but, I mean, I haven't seen anything like that. But, again, I haven't really been watching the details of this debate, because I know, like I said, everything's going to, you know, get, you know, tinkered out in conference. I mean, you have literally – what's having, you know, because you've never really had it in like what feels like forever in Washington, D.C., an actual legislative fight where you have one bill in the House versus one bill in the Senate, and then they're going to have to come together and they're going to have to marry the two. And, you know, things that were good in the House, you know, maybe put in, things that are good in the Senate, maybe put, you know, maybe taken out, et cetera, et cetera. No one knows what this final tax package is going to look until they finally reveal that conference report, if they ever get there.
Moving on to the Federal Communications Commission, it's planning to vote next month on repealing the Obama administration's net neutrality rules. Net neutrality was put in place in 2015. It's designed to ensure that internet service providers treat all online content and apps the same. Critics of the rules say they discourage ISPs from investing in their network to provide even better and faster online access. Matt, what do you see in the developments this week on net neutrality?
Well, I see a lot of bad things. I think net neutrality we need to defend. I think getting away with net neutrality is going to hurt consumers. Consumers are going to be charged more to see certain content. There's going to be a slow lane and a fast lane on the internet. And the huge corporations that control it are going to be able to set the rates. And, you know, that shouldn't be. I mean, this is a public utility, the internet. We all should be able to use it with equal access.
Kevin, is this clearing the way for internet service companies to charge users more to see certain content?
Well, I mean, it's what I think, you know, the way that Matt phrases it is so full of hyperbole, it's hilarious to see. You know, this is, you know, I'm one of these people who thinks part of the problem with net neutrality is no one ever really defines it, and that the definition has been changing since it was first declared in, what, 2003 or whatever, because it first came from all websites must be treated equal to suddenly all content must be treated equal to suddenly we all have to have the same internet service provider, you know, treating us the same. The problem is not what's happening is, you have the people who are pushing out the content, the Googles, the YouTubes, the Facebooks, et cetera, who are saying, no, we, you know, the Netflix of the world saying, no, I need to deliver myself to the customer, you know, as fast as humanly possible, about those who have built the infrastructure saying, we can't support what's currently available at the current level of infrastructure. And they need to build more stuff. They've said they need to build more stuff, like high-speed internet, Wi-Fi. I'm trying to think the new kinds of lines. I have a friend who works in the telecommunications industry. He once described this to me, and sadly, I've lost it all. But I mean, the reality is, you know, what I don't see what's wrong if you have a different service level for the different amount of service that is being offered. If you say to your mother who only emails and occasionally watches the video, Mom, this is the $7.99 a month internet plan. And then you, who are a high-octane streamer, gamer, et cetera, who is using a lot of content, who is using a lot of broadband, you know, they're going to say, yeah, you use a lot of internet. Here's the $29.99 a month plan.
Oh, those sounds like very economic plans there, economical plans there, Kevin. I'm not sure if anyone's seeing $7.99 these days. Matt, what is the difference?
Who knows?
Yeah, Matt, what is the difference if we are charging users different prices?
Well, some companies that can afford to charge to pay higher prices so they can get things faster. I mean, is that fair? You know, to the person who's at home who wants to, you know, stream their own video and. They can't afford to pay the freight, and so the company gets the preferential treatment, and so streaming at home is going to cost you more. I mean, that doesn't seem to be fair to me. I mean, that's just going to advantage the people or the companies that can pay more.
So you're saying at the Wisconsin Democracy campaign, you are not using the Spectrum business or whatever the Madison internet business program is already. You're just using a basic kind of connection, because that's already what's already happening, even in the quote-unquote world of post-2015 Obama net neutrality, where you have, here's the business link, here's the consumer link. That's essentially what's going to happen if you say, oh my God, we're going to have all this stuff. I don't see the big, giant, hair-on-fire freak out among liberals, because I actually see that this is where the guys like John Nichols and Free Press, what they really want is a government-controlled internet and a government-controlled, as you say, it's a utility. No, it's not. It's a service.
I mean, they're going to be able to block, you know, they could block stuff if they wanted to. They could give their own stuff preferential treatment.
Matt, tell me an example where someone has blocked internet traffic content from getting to someone.
They're not allowed to do it now. That's why.
It never happened, Matt.
It may happen with this change. That's the problem, Kevin. That's one of the issues.
Quit with the argument, Matt. It's never happened. It's never going to happen.
Well, we are going to.
Never going to happen. You got a real good crystal ball there, if you can say that.
We are going to break right now. In Wisconsin news, a couple of state Republican lawmakers are sounding the alarm about what a Democratic governor could mean for Foxconn in Wisconsin. Meanwhile, Foxconn this week is facing new criticism for using teenagers working overtime illegally to assemble the new iPhone 10 models, violating even China's overtime law. We'll get to state news soon on this edition of Week in Review with Matt Rothschild, the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. And Kevin Benversi is with us as well, the research director for Media Trackers. Your thoughts on the week's news, 800-642-1234. We'll be back in a moment. It is the Thanksgiving week edition of Week in Review on this morning show. On this Black Friday, Kevin Benversi is with us. He's research director with Media Trackers. And Matt Rothschild is here. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Your thoughts on Wisconsin news now. A couple of state Republican lawmakers are sounding the alarm about what a Democratic governor could mean for Foxconn in Wisconsin. Are you concerned? 800-642-1234. How do you feel about Turning Point USA being recognized as an official student organization at UW-Stevens Point? Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin, so we're hearing some concern from Senator Dan Fion and Representative Adam Neelan, who chair their respective chambers' jobs and economic development committees, saying in a statement that Democrats are so desperate to score a few cheap political points that they're willing to undermine the Foxconn deal. Democratic candidates have spoken out against the contract, which Governor Walker signed with the company officials earlier this month. They insist it costs taxpayers too much money, and some candidates have said that they want to redo it or block it. What do you make of this?
Well, I think it's both hyperbole, and they have a point on the part of the two Republican state legislators. It feels a little overblown, a little early to kind of start saying this to me, but when you have every single Democratic candidate for governor, I think it was Tony Evers this week who said, well, I've always opposed the Foxconn deal, as kind of a smack against like the Dana Walks and the Andy Gronicks, who were on the fence initially, until now it's almost become an article of faith among Wisconsin Democrats that you must oppose the Foxconn deal or you'll be ostracized from your friends and family under Team Donkey.
Article of faith, Matt?
Well, I think what the Democratic candidates are responding to is the unpopularity of the Foxconn deal across Wisconsin. I mean, once you get outside of Racine or Kenosha County, people hate this thing. It's why Walker's not even talking about it. He didn't talk about it when he announced formally for governor for getting reelected here. So the Democrats understand that this is unpopular, and there's a good reason why it's unpopular, because we've been told, the people of Wisconsin have been told time and time again that there's no money in the budget. There's no money to fix the schools. There's no money to fix the roads. There's no money for broadband. All of a sudden, you know, the first company from Taiwan with a terrible labor record that comes knocking on the door, all of a sudden there's $3 billion in the cupboards. I mean, that's just outrageous to people in this state who are wondering whether they're going to see any benefit of from it whatsoever. And especially if you're not in southeastern Wisconsin, it doesn't look like you're going to benefit from it. So there's a reason why the Democrats are talking about it and Walker's not talking about it.
Kevin, do you want to respond?
If he was talking about it, guys like Scott Ross or you would be saying he's trying to make political hay out of it. I mean, the Walker's kind of in a no-win situation when it comes to Foxconn until the first shovel's in the ground, because if he doesn't say anything, he's hiding from it. And if he does say anything, he's just trying to make political hay in it. The entire deal was a campaign thing. Honestly, this is going to be a giant wait and see. This is with every economic development, whether it's partially financed by the taxpayer or not. Is there understandable concern about where this money may come from? Naturally, it should be. That's how any deal should be dealt with and looked at. That being said, to see Democrats universally loathe this, to see Democrats coup their minority leader in the state assembly over this deal is an incredible thing to see politically in this state.
Well, as you mentioned, it is a giant wait and see. And so Foxconn has to be thinking that it is going to be supported even with a new governor in place, regardless of who that person is, Matt.
Well, the question is, do we have a democracy or do we have corporate rule here? I mean, is the corporation from Taiwan going to call the shots, or are we, the people of Wisconsin, going to call the shots when we decide who we're going to elect? And I hope it's the latter.
Well, let's move on. A conservative group is being recognized at UW-Stevens Point. After all, the Student Government Association initially denied Turning Point USA's request to be recognized on campus. Students said the group, which says it stands for free speech, the free market, and small government, encourages hate speech online and at other campuses. But the vice chancellor there reversed the SGA's decision, saying values, diversity, and the freedom to explore all ideas, even unpopular ones. Was this the right decision, Kevin, to make this organization official at UW-Stevens Point?
Yes. So, you should allow organizations of different diversities and ideologies on campus. I mean, to see this kind of draconian, no, we're not going to let you on campus mentality from the student government is a little shocking. That being said, knowing the various groups as I do in the conservative movement, if you're a young conservative and you want to choose to join Turning Point USA, if that's your choice, but there's better organizations out there, I would personally join Young Americans for Freedom. Yes, it's a much better group. Honestly, if you're at Point, you should try to get them on campus instead of Turning Point, because Turning Point's kind of seen as a joke. So that's my take.
Matt, your thoughts?
Well, I'm kind of old school. The more the merrier. I don't know the ins and outs of who decides whether the student government board is supposed to have the authority, and the administrator went over the board's head. But, I think I like having more groups as opposed to fewer groups, and there shouldn't be an ideological litmus test. I do think Turning Point USA is a joke.
But this is the group that brought in Milo Yiannopoulos to speak on a campus in the UW, Milwaukee.
Doesn't bother me.
Doesn't bother you.
No, I mean, Turning Point USA, though, it says stuff like fossil fuels save lives, and it's the group that does the McCarthyite professor watch list that I think is reprehensible, but doesn't mean I don't think they should be allowed on campus.
Let's move on to the State Elections Commission saying it wants to hire 3 additional staffers after Governor Walker eliminated 5 positions with a veto in the current budget. 2 of those requested jobs would focus on security issues due to the Russian hacking attempts to break into Wisconsin's election systems, though they did not get through. Elections Commission's the administrator, Michael Haas, says staff reductions since 2015 have weakened the ability of elections workers to address voter safety. Kevin, first, you go ahead.
I can understand the elections board saying they're understaffed. They have kind of lost a few folks over the years. My question with what they're asking for is, I mean, is this, is there a legitimate concern? Is there a legitimate security thing? Or is this just the bureaucracy saying we need more people to kind of feed us?
But it's 3 more people.
If it's the latter, I think Walker had a point. But no, I think, just say, well, it's 3 more people, it's great. Tell that to a small business that may not be able to hire 3 people because it's their.
But isn't this the election system? I mean, it seems right. I mean, shouldn't 3 people?
Again, if they can justify the need for it, I have no issue with them, bringing on 3 people. That's my intention and point.
Matt, go ahead.
Well, you know, it was bad enough. Let's just take a step back and look at the last few years that Scott Walker destroyed the Government Accountability Board that used to run elections. Now he wants to cripple its replacement agency by starving it of its necessary staff. Staff's been reduced almost by a third since 2015. And hacking is a real problem. If we, you know, what were we looking at in the last election except the possibility of hacking from the Russians? And the security of our elections is of paramount importance in a democracy. And if we have to hire three more people to give our elections more safeguards and the people of Wisconsin more certainty that our elections aren't being hacked, so much the better.
Well, let's move on here to a final topic in our last few minutes. Marathon County officials are looking into a potential mining ordinance to protect a scenic area on the Eau Claire River east of Wausau. The Dells of the Eau Claire are near a substantial ore deposit that may contain gold. The legislature passed a bill that would lift Wisconsin's nearly 20-year moratorium on sulfide mining. We've covered that, which that covers silver and gold. Governor Walker has yet to take action on the legislation, though he's expected to sign it. A Canadian company is considering potential mining sites in Marathon and Taylor counties. Kevin, what do you make about this potential mining ordinance?
Well, I mean, that's up to the people of Marathon County if they want it or not. I mean, the bigger question is going to be, will you then see, as has sadly often been the case, and, you know, I'm never really a fan of some of these, you know, unless there's legitimate, you know, things like creating, you know, like where, you know, you wanted to have these minimum wage islands throughout the state when people were passing their ordinances. You'll probably then see someone in the state legislature saying no. You know, they'll hammer and saying, you know, state rule overrules the local authority, and that's not a great thing. I mean, it's one of those things that kind of just worry me. But that being said, I am a fan of the mining legislation. I think, you know, if the people locally there want to do it, you know, why not let them build a mine? Or if they want to block the mine, let them block the mine.
Matt, go ahead.
Well, I think the mining bill is a bad bill. I certainly expect the governor to sign it. I want to salute Rob Coles, the Republican senator from Green Bay, for voting against it, the only Republican to do so. I agree with Kevin that we should support local control, and I worry about all the assaults on local control that have come out of the Walker administration and this legislature. The people of Marathon County should be able to decide whether they want that mining going on there or not.
So as we start to wrap up here, what are you thinking on this Thanksgiving week as we have looked at the news? Kevin, your final thoughts on the week and what it brought?
More strangeness, as per usual, has been 2017. It's been a weird, wild, wacky ride, and we got a month still left to go.
And Matt?
Well, it's amazing that Paul Ryan and Mitch McConnell will let Donald Trump and Roy Moore get away with anything so long as they get tax cuts for their corporate buddies and rich people by getting rid of the estate tax. That's the deal they've made with the devil.
Well, thank you both for joining us. Appreciate it. Kevin Benversi is the research director with Media Trackers, and that is a conservative media group. Matt Rothschild is the executive director of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign that tracks campaign finance. This hour of the morning show was produced by Bill Martins and Michelle Johnson. We had technical direction by Dave Potras. I'm Kate Archer Kent, and this conversation is on the Ideas Network. Coming up Monday at this time, we'll hear from the daughter of two Holocaust survivors about her book, Survivor Cafe, The Legacy of Trauma and the Labyrinth of Memory. We'll talk about how the stories of monumental 20th century events can live on as survivors of those horrors pass away. That's coming up on Monday after 8. Thanks for being with us. We'll see you next week.